Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation on the web at www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I can feel you like an ocean that won't seem to let me go.
Welcome to Signs of Life, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation with our host, Bob Ginsberg. I'm Fran Ginsberg, and our show tonight is sponsored by the Winbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential, and they can be found on the web at winbridge.org. Our guest tonight is John Kruth, and this show has been pre-recorded, so please accept our apologies as we are not able to take live calls tonight. So let's start off with bringing our listeners up to date on Forever Family Foundation happenings. We'd like to remind everybody to please check the events page on our website regularly for all events and announcements. That's foreverfamilyfoundation.org. We have three free meetings coming up this month. We have the Visionary Explorers on May 13th at 2 p.m. Eastern, 11 a.m. Pacific. This is an online group requiring pre-registration to join in the meeting. We have our afterlife discussion group on May 18th in Crown Point, Indiana. That meets at 5:45 p.m. And this is a brand new group, so I think you're going to love it if you're in the area. Our afterlife discussion group on May 23rd is in Cold Spring Harbor, New York, and that meets at 6:45 p.m. This Saturday, May 13th at 11:30 a.m. Eastern Time, don't miss our webinar with Dr. Piero Calvi Parasetti. He will be presenting Basis for a Rational Belief in Life After Life. And for our listeners, we have a special member-only coupon code for a few free seats. Grab them while you can. That code is BELIEF, B-E-L-I-E-F. And if you're not a member yet, or you're a member who has not yet satisfied our 30-day waiting period, you can enjoy a half-price seat with this code, PARISETTI. That's P like in Peter, A-R-I-S-E. TTI. Remember to sign up now as there are only a limited number of these free seats and reduced price seats. Our next webinar following this year, our next webinar of the year that follows is Surviving Death, a Journalist Investigates Evidence of an Afterlife, and that is presented by New York Times bestselling author Leslie Keene, and that will be on July 14th, 2017 at 9 p.m. Eastern. Our annual grief retreat will continue with early bird rates until the end of this month, so make your reservations before May 31st. We do, however, recommend booking early, as last year the rooms as the retreat filled and some attendees had to stay off premises. If you're booking early, please keep in mind our no refund policy. This event only gets better each year, so plan to join us this July 14th through 16th. Be one of only 50 guests who come from across the globe to spend a weekend in a beautiful and peaceful setting with like-minded people, all learning that our loved ones are still with us. The weekend is an all-inclusive one and features spirit communication with Forever Family Foundation certified mediums Rebecca Ann Lo Cicero, Joe Peretta, and Gina Simone, working alongside our other professionals and facilitators. It also includes a variety of activities and small breakout workshops, all designed to heal. And please, 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 help us keep all of our programs going by visiting our website and clicking on the donation button. It's on every single page. Because of the work we do not receive the grants and funding that all other traditional not-for-profits enjoy. You can also help us pay our bills by participating in iGive.com, Amazon.com, Amazon Smile, great nonprofits, and WellZoo. And lastly, if you are a business interested in advertising on our show, please contact us via email at businessmembership at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. And now back to you, Bob.
And we're going to go to a quick break, and we're going to bring on our guest for this evening. John Kruth is the executive director of the Rhine Research Center. So stay with us, and we'll be back in a minute or two.
It is with great pleasure that we announce the formation of the Winbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential. Dr. Julie Beischel, Director of Research at Winbridge and one of the premier investigators in the field of mediumship research, reports that the team at Winbridge will continue pursuing the many unanswered questions that remain in the field of afterlife science. Please go to www.windbridge.org to learn more about this groundbreaking research institute. That's www.windbridge.org.
Hello, I am Lloyd Auerbach, parapsychologist and author. You can learn much more about life after death, precognition, mind-matter interactions, remote viewing, ghost hunting, and other psychic experiences and research through the acclaimed Distance Learning Parapsychological Studies program at HCH Institute. Our courses are audio-based with additional written and video material. Call HCH at 925-283-3941 or visit www.hypnotherapytraining.com. Our courses include The Search for Life After Death, Being Psychic, Psychokinesis and Precognition, Ghost Hunting, Theories and Models of Psychic Experience, and more. Taken singly or as part of the certificate program, these courses will enrich your knowledge of parapsychology and the range of psychic phenomena. You'll learn about being psychic yourself. Visit www.hypnotherapytraining.com or call 925-283-3941 for information about our individual distance learning courses and certificate program.
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide a forum where individuals and families who have suffered the loss of a loved one can turn for support, information, and hope. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. The Forever Family Foundation is a joint effort of scientists, research mediums, and interested people who support the premise that life does not end with physical death. We wish to prove that the bond of the family cannot be broken even by death. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707. That's 631-425-7707. Or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. After-death communication is an accepted occurrence in many cultures throughout the world. But for many others, proof of this phenomenon is essential. And research shows that contact helps move people through loss and grief. The Sign Registry allows people to register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to specific loved ones. Contact the Forever Family Foundation at foreverfamilyfoundation.org or go directly to thesignregistry.com.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
Tuning in, our guest tonight is John Kruth. Our sponsor is the Winbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential, and they can be found on the web at windbridge.org. Bob?
And John Kruth is the executive director of the Rhine Research Center and the founder of the Rhine Education Center. He's been studying parapsychology informally for over 35 years, and he's been a formal member of the Rhine Research Team since 2009. His research has included studies related to energetic healing methods, bioenergy signatures, out-of-body experiences, qualitative case studies, mind-matter interaction, and poltergeist phenomena. John's a business leader, an educator, a parapsychologist, and as he says, he's one of the lucky people who's truly living his dream. The website for the Rhine Research Center is Rhine, R-H-I-N-E.org. And welcome to the show, John.
Well, thank you, Bob. Good to be here.
So what's a good place to start I mean, those of us who are immersed in the world of consciousness and psychic phenomena, to us, J.B. Rhine is a very prominent figure, and his work is very well known. But to the general public, they may or may not be aware of his work. So maybe a good place for us to start, if you would take a few minutes to tell us who J.B. Rhine was and the work in which he was involved.
Sure, I'd be happy to. First, I want to thank you, Bob, for having me on the show tonight. It's really great to talk to you again, and I'm really glad that we had this opportunity. When we think about the Rhine Research Center, J.B. originated at Duke University. J.B. Rhine, back in the 1920s, was actually a student at the University of Chicago, and he heard a man named Sir Arthur Conan Doyle give a talk. Now, Arthur Conan Doyle is the man who wrote the Sherlock Holmes mysteries, of course, but at that time, he wasn't speaking about Sherlock Holmes. He was actually speaking about his experiences working with mediums. And he was traveling around the country talking about the work that he had done, trying to understand mediumship and looking at it from a scientific perspective with the Society for Psychical Research. Well, J.B. Rhine was so enamored with the talk and so fascinated that he went home to his wife, Louisa Rhine, who was also a Ph.D. botanist at the University of Chicago. And he spoke to her and said, you know, I think we can study this in the laboratory environment. At that point, J.B. and Louisa started to contact different people who were doing psychical research, as it was called at that time, around the country. And they started to talk to different researchers at different universities, and they came in touch with this man named William McDougall, who was at Harvard University. Well, it just so happened that within a couple years, McDougall was coming to Durham, North Carolina, to a brand new university called Duke University. And J.B. asked if he could follow him to North Carolina and join the psychology department. And joining the psychology department, he wanted to study mediumship and do it in a very scientific way. Well, he did come to North Carolina and started to look into mediums. And of course, Bob, I know you know, mediumship was very different back in the 1920s and 30s than it is today. There was a lot of physical mediumship going on where there were faces that would appear in the room. It would always be in a dark room. People would be holding hands. There'd be a seance type of environment. But what they found is that the mediums actually seemed to be getting information that they shouldn't have gotten. Well, J.B. took this and decided, how can we determine if they're actually speaking to spirits or whether there might be something else at play? This is when he began to work with what they call Zener cards, or EFP cards, to learn more about what human potential is. And he started to study what we now call EFP, or extrasensory perception. This work went on at Duke University for about 30 years, until J.B. Rhine he'd reached mandatory retirement age and had to leave Duke University in 1965. At that point, he moved off campus, and he established a nonprofit organization that he called the Foundation for Research on the Nature of Man. Today, that same organization has been renamed the Rhine Research Center in his honor. And we're still doing research in a very similar way. Well, not in a similar way, with a similar mission, to try to explore what the limits of human potential are and to understand more about human consciousness. So that gives you a little bit of a background of what he was doing.
I think you did an excellent job encapsulating that. Appreciate it. So I mentioned also that you started the Rhine Education Center. So tell me a little bit about that.
Well, when I was... When I was out of college in the 1980s, I had a strong interest in parapsychology, and I wanted to learn more about the field and go to school further and go into graduate school. But unfortunately, within states, there was really no outlets for me to go into to study parapsychology. There was only one program, and by the time that I had finished school, it was wrapping up and closing up, and that was at JFK University. At that point, I had no outlets. I didn't know where to go to learn more in an academic environment. So I ended up studying on my own and doing a lot of reading. I had to do this by going through old used bookstores and finding other outlets where I could find academic information. As I progressed through my career and doing different jobs and things, I realized I found a way to study psychology, and I was in the town where the Ryan Research Center was. So I was able to go to the Ryan Research Center and learn a bit more about parapsychology. But there was no place for students to learn about the field and learn about the scientific aspect of the field from a reliable organization. So I worked with Christine Simmons Moore, who is now a professor at West Georgia University. And the two of us together, I had a technology background. She had established herself in the field of parapsychology. We developed the Ryan Education Center, which is an online school for parapsychology. And we're actually teaching courses now in the science of parapsychology online for people around the world. We have actually two courses that just started this week. And one of them is an introduction to parapsychology, which is a basic course in parapsychology to introduce you to the terms and the different experiments that have been done since the beginning of the field. And the second one we have that is actually starting tonight is called Lucid Dreaming. And it goes into the phenomena of lucid dreaming, talks a little bit about the experimental work, and also provides some guidance for people to how they might develop their own ability to dream, to produce lucid dreams. So the Ryan Education Center started in 2011, and we've been, I guess it's now over 6 years, we've been running courses, including certificate programs that we have running.
Right, and I know that Lloyd Auerbach, who our listeners are familiar with, is teaching some of those courses, so people can learn more by just going on the website, right, ryan.org, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah, Lloyd is a wonderful professor. He teaches a course, at least one course every quarter, it seems. And yeah. He is teaching the Introduction to Parapsychology course for us this quarter. So, yes, you can learn more at Ryan.org or go to RyanEducationCenter.org to see the course listing that we have right now.
Okay. So let's get into a little bit of research that you're involved with. I know that one of your past research projects explored the possible role of emotion and attitude, if any, on electronic devices. And I know that many parapsychologists have theorized that intense emotions somehow intensify psiability. What are your thoughts on that? Have you found similar results?
That's actually a research project that is currently running right now, where we are trying to see if there's any, you know, I worked in technology for about 17 years, and working in an office with many computer programmers, a lot of people who are doing testing, everyone around their computers all day long. You can imagine you have a lot of different experiences with the software and with the hardware. There were times where we would find that testers would get some software. They'd run their tests on it, and they'd be broken. It wouldn't work. So they'd call up the developer and say, hey, this is broken. The developer would run the same test, and it would work. And so there obviously was a disconnect somewhere. So what I found oftentimes is that the developers would walk into the tester's office, and the software would start working. At other times, there were times when the tester would walk into an office, and the software would stop working. It seemed that there was something about certain people at certain times and certain periods of their life or certain attitudes or moods they might have that seemed to affect the electronics. Well, this is, within the software industry, this is a very well-known phenomenon, but it's never been tested. No one's ever tried to see if we could do anything in a laboratory to see if there's any way that this is a real effect or something we're imagining. Now, Bob, you might have run into this sometimes where you might be working on your computer and you get really, you get frustrated with something and it's not working and you get more frustrated and it just seems it won't work.
Right.
Well, when this type of thing happens, a lot of times you wonder, well, am I just too upset? Am I just, you know, maybe I'm making mistakes? Well, maybe you are just making mistakes because you're too focused or too distracted by different things. Or maybe you're actually affecting the electronics of the machine. Hmm. We've seen in other studies that people do affect electronics. For example, at the Pear Labs that were in Princeton, New Jersey, for 25 years, they ran a study to see if people affected electronics. And that 25-year study demonstrated that, yes, people, their intention, their purposeful intention, has an effect on electronics. Well, I've done other research related to what we call poltergeist phenomena. And one of the studies that I did is with a young boy who seemed to be having an effect on electronics as well, but not on purpose. Seemed anytime he was around, the telephones would stop working. Computer systems would malfunction. But this was unconscious. Well, he was a young boy. He was 11 years old at the time. And it was very disturbing to his family. And I started to wonder, well, maybe it's because he's so anxious, because he's disturbed, because he's going through many changes in his life. This could be what's causing this effect on the electronics around him. So what I've done is designed an experiment that we can do in a laboratory to see if this unconscious activity can be generated within a software program to generate this anxiety that might activate people's effect on the machines.
Yeah,
so that's one of the projects I'm working on.
I also recall that you were working on another aspect of that where you were using meditation and mindfulness techniques to see if such phenomena would stop. So was that a separate study or related to the same study?
Boy, Bob, you've done your homework. You really know my research. When I was working with the young boy who was having the poltergeist activity, like I said, it was so upsetting to his family. A lot of people who are researchers, when they see this type of activity, one of their first thoughts are, wow, can we capture this in a lab? Can we measure this? Can we try to see if we can reproduce this to see what's making it work and what's making it happen? But my first instinct when I saw it, I met his mom and his grandmother, and this young boy was so upset about what was going on. He couldn't get a cell phone. He wanted to get a computer. You know, he was a young teenager, and he wanted to get a computer, and he couldn't because he couldn't get the computers to work. Not only this, but when he went to school, and he would be around the computers, they took computerized tests at school. There were printers that would malfunction and spit out all the paper when he went by. I mean, this would be very disturbing to anyone, but especially to a young boy. And his teachers thought he was just, you know, mischievous. He was doing it on purpose. Somehow he was sneaking and making the machines do bad things. They wanted this activity to stop. So when I saw how upsetting it was to the people in his family and to him, I could not take the standard scientific approach and just say, well, how can we reproduce this? Can I measure this? No, my first thought is, I have to help these people. How can I find ways to try to help them to stop this activity? And so I did some research and did some studying on different people over the years, and I spoke to other people who grew up and had some poltergeist activity and what had helped them. What I found is that it seems that calming their mind and being aware of what was coming next oftentimes had an effect on whether they were able to, or whether the activity occurred or not. Mm. So without treating, you know, because I'm not a medical professional and I can't treat people, but I was able to inform them about what meditation is, how to use meditation. And also, I taught this young boy when these events occurred, he should stop and take a moment to think about, what was I just thinking about? What was I just feeling? And the next time that he felt those same feelings and those thoughts, to take a moment to relax and try to see if it would affect the ability, affect whether these things continued to happen. So it was through mindfulness and meditation that within about 10 days of my visiting them and discussing this with them, the activity stopped. It wasn't occurring at all anymore. And he was using these techniques. I can't say that these techniques were directly responsible for the results, but I can say that something about him changed at that point, and it provided a way for him to feel that he was in control of the situation, and the activity stopped for a period of time.
Interesting. Of course, some might argue that the meditative techniques worked on a discarnate influence that was also affecting the process, but that's a whole other can of worms. We have to go to a break, and we're going to talk a lot more about research. I wanted to follow up a little bit about this poltergeist phenomena. So we're talking with John Kruth, the executive director of Rhine Research Center. The website is rhine.org, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes.
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide a forum where individuals and families who have suffered the loss of a loved one can turn for support, information, and hope. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. The Forever Family Foundation is a joint effort of scientists, research mediums, and interested people who support the premise that life does not end with physical death. We wish to prove that the bond of the family cannot be broken even by death. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707. That's 631-425-7707. Or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
If you're just tuning in, our guest tonight is John Kruth. Our sponsor is the Winbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential. And they could be found on the web at winbridge.org. Bob?
And we're back with John Kruth, the executive director of Rhine Research Center. When before the break, we were talking about poltergeist phenomena, and I wanted to follow up with that a little bit. I know that just about every parapsychologist that investigates poltergeist phenomena, unlike apparitions, they believe that it has everything to do with psychokinesis, recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis. And nothing to do with any discarded intervention. Are you thinking along the same lines when it comes to poltergeist phenomena? Can it always be traced to, like, emotions or extreme emotions, usually within the household?
Well, Bob, the way you describe it is very much the way that Western parapsychologists, mostly in the United States, tend to feel about it. But parapsychologists in Europe, and especially in the UK, they typically do still apply a discarnate type of effect to what they call poltergeist phenomena there as well. I tend to look at what possible explanations there are. And, of course, if it's, whether it's someone who's living or whether it's a discarnate entity, it has to be PK, right?
Right.
Because spirits don't have any physical body to have an effect on things, so it has to be some sort of psychokinetic activity. And whether that psychokinetic activity is coming directly from a living individual or from a spirit, it may also be a spirit acting through a living individual and utilizing a living individual as an agent to have effects. Any of those explanations could possibly be true. I know that we have observed people who are able to intentionally produce PK effects. I've seen this in the laboratory work that I've done, and so I tend to go with what I know. And so my first instinct is, yes, it seems to be that if there is a living agent around, that it's very possible that it might be a physical person who is the agent of the PK activity.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're doing, you and, Ryan and your team doing a lot of cutting-edge stuff, and I appreciate it. I wanted to talk about some other stuff. One thing that caught my eye, I know that many years ago there's some famous experiments that were taking place where researchers of the time were trying to measure somebody's weight before and after death. On the theory that if they're if the person's soul leaves the body, then theoretically they should weigh less. And I know that experiment is very questionable, and it was inconclusive. But what caught my eye is that you're doing some research on out-of-body experiences, and you're also looking for measurable emissions. So can you talk about that at all?
Well, experiments we were doing on out-of-body experiences were related to an original study. There was a study done back in 1908 by a man named Duncan McDougall. I was talking about William McDougall before. This is a completely different person named Duncan McDougall. He was a medical doctor. And back in 1908, he had the idea that human beings have a soul and animals don't. And so he wanted to try to run some experiment to see if he could demonstrate or measure the soul and that it existed. His way of measuring it was weighing the body. He found a number of people, he was a medical doctor, so he had a number of tuberculosis patients that he was working with. And he put them on these state-of-the-art scales for 1908, which were essentially balance scales, where he had their bed and the people on the scales, and he got them to agree to allow him to measure their weight at the time of their death and see if there was any change. Well, in his studies, he found at the time of their death they lost about 21 grams, anywhere from 18 up until about 30 grams. It averaged out to about 21 over all the different studies of weight at the time of their death. Now, this is where people have said 21 grams is the weight of the soul. You may have heard this before.
Yeah.
Well, Duncan McDougall had also did the same experiment with animals, and he found no change in weight with animals. So he confirmed his hypothesis that human beings have a soul and animals don't. Now, when someone confirms their hypothesis so clearly, I get a little suspicious. But, you know, this was 1908, and he was trying to do his best to try to measure these physical activities that might be an indication of the soul. Back in 1990s, another man named Lou Hollander wanted to replicate these experiments. No one had done anything to replicate these experiments for about 80 years, and you can imagine why, because they're, first of all, it's kind of morbid, and it's not so easy to get people to volunteer to have themselves weighed at the time of their death.
I would imagine.
So, so Lou Hollander actually used animals. Rather than using people, he used animals. And he took a number of sheep and goats, and these are the animals, sheep and goats, not how we usually speak in parapsychology of sheep and goats. But he took animals, and they were destined for slaughter. He euthanized them and had a veterinarian there to make sure everything was done in a very humane way. And he weighed them at the time of their death and took into account all the variables he could think of. And he used the more sophisticated scales that they had at that time. And he did measure a change in weight for these animals. But instead of a weight loss, he actually found a weight gain. He found a weight gain of about, probably about 40 grams, I think, is what he found. This is in direct conflict with what McDougall had found about 80 years before. So the question, I had someone call me and say, well, you know, I'm interested in replicating these experiments. And my first thought is, well, I really don't want to kill anyone, whether it be a person or an animal, to make this. And so we tried to, he said, no, I have a better idea. He said, why don't we see if we can get in touch with people at the Monroe Institute in Virginia? They are training people to go out of body. Because Robert Monroe, who founded the Monroe Institute, had written about his travels out of the body. So he said, why don't we try to find people and see if when they go out of body, if we have any change in weight? Well, we just happened at the Rhine to have Lou Hollander's original scales that he used in his experiments in the 1990s. And so we set up a pilot study where we set up the scales, got all the software together and got the conditions right, and invited some people from the Monroe Institute. It was a small pilot study, so there were only three people involved to come down and do some experiments with us. My first thought when we did this study was that I don't know if we're going to find any weight differences, but we need to consider some other variables as well. So we included things like a random number generator, and we have another lab, which is the bioenergy lab, which measures very low-level ultraviolet light emissions from people. And we tried to see whether there would be any of the correlation between light emissions, the random number generator, and the weight of people whenever they go out of body. One of the tricks, a lot of people say they go out of body, but they do it spontaneously. We needed people who could do it intentionally and on command within a small period of time. But we did find three people who were willing and able to do this. And we did, in our initial studies, find that there was a change in weight whenever these people said they went out of body. Just like Lou Hollander's experiments, we found there was a weight gain when people go out of body. Now, a lot of people would wonder, well, you know, if there's a soul and it has some sort of physical properties, when the soul leaves the body, or when the spirit leaves the body, or when a person decides to leave their body and travel to another direction, another location with out-of-body experiences, wouldn't they get lighter? Well, if the soul or the spirit is lighter than physical matter, lighter than air, like helium, or like hydrogen, if it's lighter, it would have a buoyant property. This is, and when you think about many of the stories of near-death experiences, they talk about how the spirit seems to rise to the ceiling and move up. So that indicates that there may be a buoyancy factor related to this. So our initial results indicated that there was a weight gain, but the problem is that we're using the same scales that Lou Hollander did, and that was the same results he got. So my initial experiments, I can't really be sure that they were due to a soul or spirit leaving the body and not just an artifact of the scale. So one of the projects that we're working towards is getting a new set of scales that we can use that are state-of-the-art, that we can redo this experiment in a more profound way.
Mm. Yeah, interesting. It's an interesting theory that the body would actually become more dense when the soul or energy was no longer there, which would be the lightness. So the absence of light makes you more dense, which makes you heavier.
Yeah. Right. Yes. Yeah. So, well, it's like if you take the air out of a balloon, it's going to fall to the ground.
Now, you're also doing work with healers, and that's an interesting offshoot, because healing, distant healing, would be a form of psychokinesis, and you're trying to understand the process. You have any thoughts about what may be taking place in a healing situation?
We have a number of different. In fact, healing research is what we're focused on this year at Rhine. I have a number of different. We have two different groups at the Rhine who studied the healing work of William Bengtson, who'd come up with a technique that he's used in a number of research studies and has demonstrated some potential to be a strong healing force. Well, these groups have actually been practicing for about 4 years, and include both two different groups, and using this same method, and working together, meeting on a weekly basis to do healing work. This is one of the hardest things to find within the field of parapsychology, is someone who is trained and focused and dedicated and has a history of doing this work. Now that we have these groups, our question is, well, are they actually doing anything? Can we measure what they're doing? And so we're trying to set up some studies this year to see if we can see if these groups would have an effect on sick animals or plant growth and the health of plants. And we're also looking at what is the experience of being part of these healing groups for not only the healers, but also for the people who might be treated within these groups as well. Mm-hmm. So these are a couple of the different healing projects we have going on. Now, you mentioned one thing, Bob. You said healing is a form of psychokinesis. I'm not so sure of that. And that's one of the other things that we're looking at as well. I have, like I said, I have equipment that I have set up at the Rhine to measure whether people affect electronics and whether people are performing psychokinesis. You would think healers would have an effect on these machines if they're doing psychokinesis. But I don't find that all the time. I find that there are some healers that seem to have an effect on the machines, but other healers who have had long careers as healers, that have many clients who talk about the benefits, talk about being feeling better and being healed by these people, I get absolutely no results at all whenever I put them into my lab and test for psychokinesis. So I think that there are different approaches to healing, and that some of them, if you consider that, you know, there are some people who, if you have a problem with, like, say your knee's bothering you, they might focus directly on your knee and try to address the issue directly with your knee and use a very focused intention to affect it. There are other healers who might say, well, your knee is part of a system, and rather than treating the knee specifically, we might consider that there might be some imbalances in the body. So we're going to look at the energies of the entire body, and not only in your energies or your body now, but also throughout your lifetime, the types of things you eat, and treat people in a more holistic way. It seems that those types of healers who are less specific and directed towards a specific target, it seems they don't demonstrate PK. So yeah, maybe the approach that people are taking.
It is interesting and a great mystery. I know one thing I found fascinating, you mentioned Bill Bengston. If you listen to Bill talk about how he does his research with mice, and he acts as the healer, he's not meditating, he's not focusing. He describes it as being bored out of his skull. He just sits there. So it's amazing.
Yes, Bill is quite a character, and he often talks about how he's really not doing anything. But, you know, and I believe that he might have a feeling like he's not doing anything, but the fact is, he's there, healing is occurring. It seems that he must play some sort of role in the process. But I actually did have Bill in one of my labs when he came down, and I had no readings related to PK at all, none.
Yeah, interesting. Well, we'll count on you to find the answers. We have been talking. Unfortunately, we've reached the end of our time, which is a shame because there's a lot more to talk about, but you'll have to come back again. We're talking with John Kruth. John's the executive director of the Rhine Research Center. You can learn a lot more about the history, about the research, about the education, the online courses, and other projects. Just visit Rhine, RHINE.org. John, thanks for being with us tonight, and hope to talk to you again real soon.
Thank you very much, Bob. It was nice to talk to you tonight.
Appreciate it. Have a good evening.
We now ask our listeners to please join us in our Healing Energy Circle prayer. May the universe create a channel of healing energy from all participants.
Okay. I don't know, just kind of a little shakiness in the force there, audio force. All right, we're going to do that again right as you're about to close. 5, 4, 3, 2.
We are now asking our listeners to please join us in our Healing Energy Circle prayer. May the universe create a channel of healing energy from our participating listeners, sending that energy to those who are in need of recovery of the physical body, spirit, and mind, as we visualize the healing light upon Linda Ellis, Eddie, Sandy Raybould, Bob Stahl, Alex Hanna, Veronica James, Rich LeBly, Lauren Ramnath, Vince Mattia, Isabel Ginsberg, Diane Archangel, James Rafferty, Donna Mello, Stanley Mullen, Marianne Pierschke, Glenna Irwin, David Hayes, Michael Tim, Helen Montalto, Cynthia Post, Evelyn Ingram. And now let us, as one consciousness, give our energy of loving thought by praying like this: to love one another, to treat others as we would like to be treated, to forgive others and return love for hate, kindness for anger, to spread this feeling to everyone, to our fellow man, as well as the earth and its environment. And now it's time to say,
our loved ones are only a heartbeat away.
And science is going to prove it.
Good night, everyone.